Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar that will shed some light and talk about Friday's court's decision regarding the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. I'll let the panelists provide the background, but I think it's safe to say that the decision from the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia will have a significant impact on how collection agencies attempt to communicate with individuals going forward. This webinar is being generously sponsored by TCN, and I want to thank them for participating as a sponsor of today's event. I also wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. The site is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. It publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and Getting to Know profile, as well as hosts webinars and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Tom Good is the managing attorney at the law firm of Barron & Neuberger. Prior to joining the firm in 2014, he spent a decade as general counsel at two of the largest participants in the industry, Square 2 Financial and Asset Acceptance Capital. For both companies, he directed all legal affairs, negotiated both debt and equity financing, and made legal decisions for the client relating to compliance and regulatory matters. Donald Maurice is a partner at Maurice Wucher, where he provides counsel to the financial services industry. He successfully argued before the 3rd, 4th, and 8th Circuit U.S. Courts of Appeals, and has represented the financial services industry in trials of individual and class actions, and as counsel for amicus curiae before the United States Supreme Court. He counsels clients in regulatory actions before the CFPB and other federal and state regulators, and in the development and testing of debt collection compliance systems. He serves as outside counsel to RMA International, as a regent of the American College of Consumer Financial Services Lawyers, and on the governing committee of the Conference of Consumer Finance Law. Scott Wortman focuses his practice on consumer financial services litigation at Blank Rome, including individual and class action defense, regulatory proceedings, and administrative investigations. Additionally, he represents and counsels clients on corporate and regulatory compliance procedures in a wide variety of consumer financial areas. Scott is also a strategic advisor to fintech and other digital business clients on privacy issues, data and cybersecurity, vendor management, and consumer protection. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by me. We encourage everyone to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Also, today's webinar is an audio-only event. A recording of the event will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, before we launch into the discussion, I want to read the following disclaimer. The information shared today is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to assure the information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not of their organization. And with that, let's begin today's discussion. So, the appeals court ruling addressed four different aspects of the TCPA, three of which are of consequence to the ARM industry, and two of which are likely to present the potential for agencies to change their policies and procedures. So let's start with one of those. Let's start with the definition of an auto dialer. Scott, maybe you can walk us through how that has changed as a result of this ruling.
Oh, I think first as a preliminary matter, I just want to point out that the D.C. Circuit didn't offer alternatives necessarily to the FCC's order. Rather, it assessed the legal basis and rationale for the order, setting aside certain provisions. So things got better, but as it stands, there are still some ambiguous holes, such as the definition that need to be closed up. The Court of Appeals did expressly set aside the FCC's effort to clarify the types of calling equipment that fall within the TCPA's restrictions. And the court even stated that the FCC's understanding would appear to subject ordinary calls from any conventional smartphone that we all carry to the act's coverage, which would be an unreasonably expansive interpretation of the statute. So, you know, since this is a new decision and there really hasn't been much noise to influence any of our readings of the decision, it may actually be beneficial for purposes of this webinar. But I'd be remiss not to read one quote, I think, that helps with the view clarifying ATDS in a world post this decision. And the the quote is, if every smartphone qualifies as an ATDS, the statute's restrictions on autodialer calls assumes an eye-popping sweep. Imagine, for instance, that a person wishes to send an invitation for a social gathering to a person she recently met for the first time. If she lacks prior express consent to send the invitation, and if she obtains the acquaintance's cell phone number from a mutual friend, she ostensibly commits a violation of federal law by calling or sending a text message from her smartphone to extend the invitation. And then if she sent a group message inviting 10 people to the gathering, again without securing prior express consent, she not only would have infringed the TCPA 10 distinct times, but would also face a minimum damages recovery against her of $5,000. And of course, the consumer attorney would probably say $15,000, but who's counting? So again, just to cut this a little bit shorter, while the ruling set aside the FCC's expansive and overly broad interpretation of capacity, having the apparent defect of embracing pretty much all telephonic communication equipment, that is, except for the infamous rotary phone, the court's ruling does not offer alternatives, though there are some cases decided by the courts post-declaratory order that do offer some guidance, which are consistent with the circuit court's ruling from Friday.
Excellent. Thanks. Don, I want to reach out to you next. Do you agree that there's still some work to be done in terms of what comes next and how collection agencies can sort of interpret this ruling?
Well, of course. But let me go back a bit and talk about what happened in 2015. There was many petitions brought to the FCC asking it to specifically do something that it was supposed to do in its role as a regulator of the TCPA, a role that Congress had tasked it with back in 1991 at the enactment, and that was help clarify what type of devices would bring you within the TCPA. And so there were at least 20 petitions, many of them requesting this. And after a good amount of time to mull that concept over, the FCC came up with what I have to say is probably the most egregious example of rulemaking or authority that a commission could do. And this is really what this decision is about. It talks at length about the Administrative Procedures Act and the so many ways in which the 2015 order violated it. And to put it into a simpler context, what the role of the FCC was supposed to be with the 2015 order was to provide clarity specifically to the industry so it knows what it's supposed to do. But I think what the FCC did was grasp the concept of absurdity and apply it throughout that ruling, so that it made no sense at all what was covered. What they were clear, though, as Scott pointed out, everything but a rotary phone potentially fell within the purview of an ATDS. And one court here in Pennsylvania, one federal court in 2017 put it best when they said that the ruling best resembles a mongrel, with no offense to dogs. The court expressed quote-unquote dismay that the majority of FCC commissioners would have issued that order without any characterization of what an ATDS is. And what upset the court is that this order would end up and did infect numerous district courts with, to quote it, a disease of uncertainty. And that's what you read coming from the D.C. Circuit here. What the Bureau did was to say, for example, when posed with human intervention, well, you know, human intervention, it says at one point, may take you outside of what an ATDS is. But at the same time, it would say, but maybe human intervention would not mean that you're necessarily not an ATDS and you were still covered by the TCPA. And what the decision says is you can't have it both ways. It's one or it's the other. And I think what I like best about this decision is its discussion of the concept, if you want to call it that, but I think it's best to go back to the word absurdity, of potential capacity, where you could download an app or flip a switch or attach a piece of hardware to a phone sitting on your desk right now, and suddenly it would become an ATDS, even if you never used it for that purpose. The fact that that potentiality exists would be enough to bring you within the TCPA under the use of an ATDS if you were dialing a cell phone without prior express consent using that phone that sits on your desk. And what the court said is that when we look at the TCPA, and there's a discussion in there where they go back to 1991 and they look at the congressional findings. And the Congress had said, well, you know, we got 30,000 businesses telemarketing, and that's 300,000 potential solicitors. And then the court says, but when I look at the FCC's 2015 order, it's hundreds of millions of people, because it's everyone using a smartphone becomes a TCPA violator. In fact, that is not what Congress intended. And I think they use the word, in fact, it's absurd to even suggest that. So for me, I like that there's this outright attack on the complete ridiculousness of the potential capacity argument. And I like to use the phrase, the dialing back on the broad scope that the potentiality concept brought to the understanding of ATDS. So I think going forward, that is a huge benefit to the industry. Now, do we know what a dialer is with any specificity? No, that's not the court's role. That's the FCC's role. But I think that for the purposes of moving forward, we can now look at equipment, look at what equipment does, look at things like human intervention, and this is all going to have to work itself out in litigation until the FCC gets itself in order and starts to make real rules and provide real guidance. But we can bring these things back in. We can argue against the potential capacity and say that we have to look at present capacity. We have to look at what the machine was doing, what the intention of the device was, and how we deployed it. These are all defenses that we would typically use in the past that were hurt by potentiality. I got to tell you, Mike, when I looked at the 2015 order, I remember either saying it or writing it. It looked to me like the FCC commissioners who signed on to that sat down with a group of consumer TCPA plaintiffs' attorneys and came up with the most confusing uncertainty that they could to fuel TCPA litigation. Well, fortunately, that's been undone.
And Don, just to piggyback off of that, if you recall, Commissioner O'Reilly, when he was in the dissent, when the declaratory ruling in order first came out in 2015, he referred to it as maddening, unfathomable, unworkable, incredible, not in the good way, ludicrous, preposterous, and a farce, among other colorful descriptions that he used. And I agree with you. I think that, you know, this was a paradoxical ruling by the FCC that the basic function of an auto dialer is to dial numbers without human intervention, but a device might still qualify as an auto dialer even if it cannot dial numbers without human intervention, which is just an inconsistency that I'm happy that this court is pointing out.
Yeah, this decision, frankly, in my view, I don't know if people are going to run out and necessarily change what they do tomorrow based on it, although they could. In my view, the victory here is that we didn't lose, because I'm not sure how anyone, if you took the literal reading of the FCC and said, this is how we're going to do business, I'm not sure how anyone does it, because everything's an ATDS. And, you know, unless you're willing to go back to rotary phones, everything would have been subject to at least evaluation under the TCPA to see if you're running afoul. And that was no way to do business. And you know, I think courts sometimes give hints as to what they're thinking of when they give kind of absurd little hypotheticals. And Scott read the one that I had circled too, which was, you know, the social friend who manages to rack up $5,000 of minimum liability just by inviting people to a party. And to its credit, the FCC really didn't back down from that. They didn't claim in their argument that the smartphones were outside of the law. They were willing to go all the way down the road with it, with that interpretation of the reg.
Now let me reading some of the Go ahead.
Yeah, and so you know, to follow up with that, another concept that I think gains more importance is, again, going back to the statutory definition, and the court does that here and says that we have to, well, at least the statute looks at an ATD as itself as having the ability to generate random or sequential numbers to be dialed, and points out that the commission has never answered that question adequately, and certain doesn't do it here. And I think that another thing going on here may be that it may open up some of the 2003 order and allow others, and I think in future rulemaking this is going to come back, is that maybe an essential element would be to have that type of capacity in the ATDS. So that would help a lot. It would help a lot if we can move off of that and get something that helps define it, because I think people are going to be able to easily choose the equipment that they want to avoid TCPA liability if we get some guidance like that.
So just to summarize, before we consider moving on to the next area of the ruling, what happened is that the appeals court said that what the FCC, how the FCC defined auto dialers in 2015 was wrong. They go back to the original definition or what was included in the TCPA, and that's how everybody moves forward. Am I summarizing that properly for everybody?
Well, I think I would say that the 2015 order can now be put at the bottom of the birdcage. It's not guidance. You cannot as either an advocate or as a defendant look to it and say, well, this is guidance, because so much of it dealing with ATDS, mind you, just ATDS here, is now vacated. It's gone. So
is such a relief to somebody who tries to advise people to or how to comply with TCPA outside of the litigation mode. You were always uncertain given this, whether or not the equipment you were looking at and the software you were looking at really fell inside or outside of the TCPA. And that level of uncertainty has certainly been reduced by this.
It also allows us to focus on some of the court decisions that have come out post 2015, where they were looking at the order and trying to find ways around the confusing language provided by the FCC. I mean, this is where sort of the point and click software and the manual intervention processes come into play. And I could probably think of about three cases off the top of my head where the manual intervention point and click software has been proven to be perfectly fine, even though, again, if you look at the declaratory order and ruling, it's questionable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was a question that came in while we were having this discussion, and before we move on, maybe it's best to tackle it now. And it's just confirming, can you still call on a dialer under any circumstance if you have permission from the consumer prior? Does anyone want to tackle that?
Well, it doesn't change the requirement that you have to have consent to call certain devices, including a cellular mm-hmm. phone, prior express consent. So if you have the prior express consent of a consumer to call the consumer, then you can call the consumer.
Yeah, it doesn't touch that. That's the one core thing that the industry was driving at was that if you have the prior consent, you can make the call, assuming that the prior consent is still effective.
Okay. There was another question that came in via email before the webinar started. And the question is, are text messages still considered auto dials?
Yes.
Yes.
It's still,
yes.
If the device meets all the other attributes, a cell phone would fall within. I mean, of course, the device sending it has mm-hmm. to be itself an ATDS, right?
Correct, but that's been fairly longstanding. That's outside of the scope of this decision.
Okay, I think we can move on to the next area covered in the ruling, and that's the one called Safe Harbor. Tom, why don't you walk us through how the court's ruling will impact calling strategies and campaigns for collection agencies going forward?
Well, the one call Safe Harbor, what the commission tried to do was they tried to say, or they were dealing with the circumstance where you had consent from a consumer or from the owner of a number, and that number got reassigned to another individual. And so what do you do with the circumstance that a consumer, or that you have consent from one person, but they no longer own the number? And what the commission tried to do is they tried to say, well, it isn't right, and this was a big gift, with my tongue firmly in cheek, it isn't right that on the first call to the existing number where he had consent, but has been transferred, that there be liability for making that call. So we'll let the person making the call have one bite at the apple, basically, where you can make one call or one text message to the number, and then any call after that would subject the person to liability. The issue with that, and what the court was concerned about was, you know, once again, one of those hidden messages from the court. They referenced in the FCC's findings that they had found a case where somebody had waited for 900 text messages to come in before notifying the person placing the or giving the messages that the ownership of the number had changed. And so there's kind of a snake in the grass position there. The court initially dismissed an argument made by the industry that, you know, the consent from the original owner also applies to the person that currently receives the call. And but what they did say is they said that the one call post assignment Safe Harbor was arbitrary and capricious, and they struck it down. That puts you in a situation where at least, you know, you have a litigation position to operate. From an operational perspective, I think once you receive notice that the number's been transferred, you have to stop contacting that number, clearly. But at least you don't have to worry about the situation where you have the person who's just racking up messages and calls trying to get the biggest possible TCPA case you have.
Yeah, as noted originally by the dissenting commissioners, there are, and this is completely supportive, there are 37 million telephone numbers reassigned each year. And the court appears to have incorporated the reasoning behind Commissioner Pai's dissent, which is that the order's strict liability approach leads to perverse incentives. Most significantly, creates a trap for law-abiding companies by giving litigious individuals a reason not to inform callers about a wrong number. And it's this type of approach found in the FCC's now mostly overruled declaratory ruling and order that helps spawn thousands of high exposure class cases across the United States, which cost legitimate taxpaying American businesses, including the arm industry, hundreds of millions of dollars.
You know, we all have heard stories about plaintiffs that have multiple phones sitting on their desk, just racking up possible TCPA violations, and I think that's offensive to courts at a certain level. And when the industry was able to make the case that you know, the one call Safe Harbor really wouldn't address that, I think that went a long way to getting it struck down.
I agree. There are literally individuals subsidizing their income as professional TCPA plaintiffs, sending out demand letters to companies for every call, text, or fax they receive, and working to ensure they receive such calls by acquiring new cell phone numbers, signing up online for promotional campaigns, and also making outbound calls to companies. There are blogs, there are websites telling consumers how a small investment can bring them a fortune in the TCPA. And I think this ruling severely limits that fortune, thankfully.
All right, so I'll chime in on this as well. I like the discussion here on the reassigned numbers, and I like that the one safe harbor is vacated because, of course, you know, reading the 2015 order, if you're a court, if it says you have one safe harbor on a reassigned call, well, then I guess that every single call that followed, no matter what, would be a violation. And that's the way the court looked at it here, was saying that makes no sense. You know, what's your rationale, FCC, for the one safe harbor call? And they pointed the FCC to their reasonable reliance standard that is how they judge whether or not you obtain prior express consent. So it goes back to who gave you that consent. And here, with the reassigned numbers, it's the person you intended to call, the intended recipient of the call. So in the first part of the decision, the court here reaffirms the standing, the principle that the present subscriber is the person you need to have consent from to make the call. And that's certainly something that we've seen in various circuit courts of appeals. The 11th Circuit, Osorio, comes to mind as one. It's a present subscriber. But at the same time, that standard asks that we look at the facts and circumstances under which the consent was given, and was it reasonable for you to conclude that you had consent? And then it applies it to the one call and says, well, if it was reasonable for one call, why wouldn't it follow that it would be reasonable for others? And that's key. Because I think that sets up the horrible dilemma that a caller can get into when they start calling a reassigned number and for whatever reason, because they weren't able to check on a list or pull it from a reassigned number database, or because the person they're calling never responds, they've got call after call after call to that reassigned number, and they've got no facts provided to them indicating that that number was reassigned. Now, I think this decision opens up, at least in the short term, until the FCC provides some rulemaking on it, and the court notes that such is in progress, that you can look at the facts and circumstances behind the reason why that number was called and look to see if it was reasonable for you to rely on your prior consent to have made those calls, and whether there were any factors which would have indicated to you that the number had been reassigned. And I think that's very helpful. I think that's one of the points that really bothered me about the 2015 order, was that bright line that you get your one call and then you're really in trouble for the rest of them just seemed to me to be too onerous, too harsh on callers. And there was really no way that you could protect yourself. And that if you took every possible step to find out if the number was reassigned and you had all of these wonderful and expensive compliance procedures in process to do it, sorry, you're out of luck. You had your one call and now you got to start paying up. And the court rejected that.
You know, I do think that from an operational perspective, you need to be careful that if you are put on notice that the number has been reassigned, you have to block that number. Because if what we're going to wind up doing is litigating the reasonableness, if you have a fact in that case, or at least from my perspective, that you knew it was a number that wasn't owned by your debtor, you know, you have to move on from that, and that could be getting a voicemail or being told that's the wrong number, and this is really a training opportunity for the people that are on the phones in your agencies.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that what the reassignment does is support that you have those procedures in place that are there for you to identify reassigned numbers from all various sources, and that you follow those procedures in terminating calls to that number after you discover it's reassigned. So that all is part of that reasonableness that you could show in your defense when you're having to deal with a claim on a reassigned number.
Okay. There's been a few questions that have come in that are on this topic, so let's see if we can't tackle those. Current cases, like current wrong number TCPA cases before the courts using the old one call safe harbor, any ideas on what happens to those cases now?
You got a far better defense today than you had on Thursday of last week.
Yeah, and as Don alluded to, or perhaps it was Tom, the FCC's new leadership, they're ready on their way to designing a regime to avoid the problems of the 2015 one-call safe harbor. Just recently, the FCC sought comment on potential methods for requiring service providers to report information about number reassignments, and that's for the whole purpose of reducing unwanted robocalls. And also the commission is considering even whether to provide a safe harbor for callers that inadvertently reach reassigned numbers, even after consulting the most recently updated information.
Here's another question, an interesting one. What would be reasonable now in terms of numbers to call before you find out a numbers, or if you don't find out a number has been reassigned?
Well, if you have no basis for knowing that the number is reassigned, and you're not getting the voicemail messages that gives a different name, and you're not being told, why are you calling me? I don't know who you are, sort of messages. Then I think that you can provide yourself with a pretty good TCPA defense. Now the question then becomes, are you somehow going to stumble into an FDCPA call frequency type approach? Although I'm not sure how that would really fly, but I have heard some people chatting about that in the last day or two.
And Tom, just to circle back on something you said, which I think was interesting, you're talking about the training opportunity. What you're saying is, if a collector is making a call and gets a voicemail and says, hi, you've reached Mike Gibb, when they're supposed to be trying to reach Tom Good, that's an indication that a number has been reassigned. That's what you're referring to, right?
Absolutely. If they're going to tell you got the wrong person, either directly or through their voicemail, your collectors need to know to raise their hand and say, I think we have a wrong number here. I think we have to update our system. And you have to encourage your people to do that because, looking at it from a legal perspective, I think you're going to have more difficulty defending that action once you've been provided that notice.
Here's an interesting question, which may take us off on a bit of a tangent. But let me ask it anyways. What if we suspect the person on the phone is giving us erroneous information? What if I'm actually am Tom Good, but I say it's Mike Gibb in my voicemail? Is there anything that can be done with that?
Yes. Please, Tom.
Go ahead.
Please go ahead.
No, I have to say yes.
If the person says it's there's a few ways to look at this one. If the person says it's Mickey Mouse and not Mike Gibb, that would be a pretty good indication that you should investigate further. However, if the person uses a different name that sounds like it could be a reassigned phone number, you need to investigate. The onus is on you as the agency to make that determination. And if you make the wrong determination, it could be costly. However, there's nothing that prevents you from using skip tracing and other resources to make a determination as to whether or not the person simply changed the name on the phone, perhaps to avoid the phone calls.
I agree with everything that you just said, but then I have to ask one question to the agency owner or the collection manager. If the guy's willing to lie about his name in order to try to avoid the call, will making another call to them cause the consumer to raise his hand and say, "You're right, you caught me. I'll pay now." You know, it seems to me that when somebody is willing to be that crass a liar, the likelihood of collecting money by making additional calls is probably pretty remote. Especially when you weigh that against the possibility that they're not lying about their name and you may be racking up TCPA liability.
I know that a number of collection agencies were scrubbing their databases to try to identify numbers that had been reassigned. Do they still need to do that going forward, or is that something that they don't need to do as frequently?
No. You got to keep doing that, and you got to have, that's what we keep hitting on here. You got to have procedures in place. This is a question of reasonable reliance, and it's going to look at what you're doing to find reassigned numbers and what you're doing with the facts that you gather concerning the status of the number, and then how you implement that into your call strategy. So you've got to be doing that. And in fact, one of the things that the opinion mentions is that the FCC is engaged, I think we mentioned it already, in looking at this issue, including updating and creating a more robust database for reassigned numbers. So that's a critical part of what you should be doing, and doing it often.
And I think they do give you kind of the what they believe the future state will be, which is that there'll be some sort of centralized database, and you're going to be able to check and see if a number's been reassigned or not, and do so on an automated basis. And I think once that database is available, anybody who doesn't hit that database and check it, you know, they're liable. At least that's my belief. Once the database is up and running.
Yeah. I think the important thing to remember is that this vacates the one call safe harbor, so that you don't have a court reading that you get one call and the rest you're liable to, and it opens up the potential to defend on other calls made to the reassigned number. But that doesn't mean you can be reckless and just go off and start calling reassigned numbers without any liability. You're going to have the same issues that we had before the 2015 order. The 2015 order just made it more onerous on you and heightened your liability, but you need to have a good compliance policy and follow it for dealing with that potential of a reassigned number.
I agree, and I think now is even maybe a good time for the ARM industry to review existing consents that they may have. And also policies and procedures. I mean, I've seen a few policies and procedures where, you know, we've had to make changes where it's very important to make sure that you're not capturing inbound numbers and automatically uploading them into your system without proper protocols. And if you capture telephone numbers and inbound calls, you really have to make sure you have proper consent for that new phone number. You also want to, I think, analyze at this point. Now is a great time. Almost like a spring cleaning. Look at your technology that you're using for scrubbing for cell phone numbers, or perhaps reassigned cell phone numbers.
Okay. As I take my notes here and catch up, let me ask this. So the ruling came out Friday. Today's Monday. You know, should collection agencies be flipping switches and change, you know, rewriting policies and procedures today? Is it something where they should be waiting and seeing how some of the pending court cases sort of pan out? You know, can you give any insights into how quickly this ruling should be reflected in what a collection agency is doing, you know, when it's making its calls? And Scott, I'll ask you first.
You know, again, I just want to point out that the D.C. Circuit, it didn't offer alternatives to the FCC's order. It simply assessed the legal basis and rationale for the order. It set aside certain provisions. So I don't know if it's necessarily right now making changes in recommendations that myself Don and Tom have probably made to our clients. It's more about how these actions are going to be interpreted and used to your advantage rather than against you. The one thing that I would point out from reading the court's order as well as recent case law is it's becoming more imperative to make certain that your vendors and any subcontractor agents are following the rules, are following the TCPA, excuse me. By way of example, the U.S. District Court in Illinois, there's the Dish Network case where they had to pay, I think it was somewhere along the lines of $280 million in statutory damages for violating various statutes, including the TCPA. And these alleged violations were mostly carried out by vendors. So one thing that I would point to is now that we have a better idea of what the rules are, although there still are ambiguities, you definitely want to look to your vendors, your subcontractors, and your agents to make sure that they're also following these rules.
You know, and to get back to the initial question, and I agree absolutely with everything you just said, but I think that anytime there's a major case, and you know, we can argue about how major this is, but I think it's pretty important. You know, that should be a precipitating event to look at your processes, look at your training, make sure that you're doing things, you know, in a fashion that both complies with the law and makes good common or good business common sense. And, you know, we're talking about the TCPA today, so we ought to be looking at our policies relating to the TCPA today and tomorrow and for the foreseeable future in order to make sure that we are doing the things that make the most sense from both business and compliance basis.
Based on the reaction from both ACA International and the FCC to the ruling, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyways because I'm definitely not considered the expert here in the room. But do you anticipate that this ruling ends the suit between the ACA filed against FCC, or do you anticipate an appeal on any level? I'm going to guess it means that everyone thinks it's. Silence means that everyone thinks.
I'm sorry,
right?
Mike.
That's okay.
This is Don Maurice. I mean, I don't know if the FCC is going to appeal it. I mean, there was some pretty harsh language here about the rulemaking and the way it was done. And I agree with the look. I don't agree with the decision on the basis that it's good for the industry that I've been part of for so long. I agree with its analysis as it pertains to the Administrative Procedures Act, which is that bad of rulemaking. I mean, it's reprehensible what was done. But I think there's something else, and this goes to your next question too, Mike. There's another element of this decision that we haven't talked about yet that the court touched on. It was revocation of consent, or did I miss that?
No, we haven't gotten there
go
yet.
Ahead.
Yeah. Do you want to get to that before we talk about where this may be headed? Because it was, I think, a sure. really important ruling from the court. And, you know, we saw here in the Third Circuit some early decisions, even before the 2015 order, on revocation of consent and how it could be revoked. And so you saw so many lawsuits where persons were saying they revoked consent and they revoked consent even though they gave it. And it became a subject of litigation after the 2015 order. And it left that in place. It did leave it in place. So today, just like last week, a consumer can continue to revoke consent to receive the ATDS call at any time and through any reasonable means. But the court went out of its way to talk about what the 2015 order did not say, which it didn't have to do, and gave, I think, some pretty good guidance that we should think about. And one was is that although the court recognizes here that you can't unilaterally prevent someone from revoking consent, With a nod to the Second Circuit and the Reyes decision, said that doesn't mean that you can't make efforts in your contract, for example, to make it a material term that you cannot revoke consent. So that's important, and the Reyes decision from the Second Circuit goes to that point. And they also pointed out in the decision that it does not, and I love this, it did not foreclose the ability of the caller, in this case the agency, to deploy, and I'll quote it, clearly defined and easy to use opt-out methods for consumers who no longer want to receive these calls. And I think that that was important, because what scares me about revocation of consent when I have to look at defending a case is that it could have been buried in a 14-page diatribe from the consumer about everything but making calls. And it could have been like just a few words, I revoke consent to any ATDS calls. And you know, I don't think necessarily we're all going to be parsing through all of those available means, because it is pretty broad and that is affirmed. But the court here may have provided us a nice ability to at least lessen the risk that we could miss a revocation. And I think it was a very important part to look at, because the court said, I think it recognizes it, they want to avoid, and I'll quote them again, any effort to sidestep the available methods that you provide through these easy-to-use opt-out methods by a consumer choosing, and I'll quote, idiosyncratic or imaginative revocation requests, because these, the court says, may seem unreasonable. So it's bringing that reasonableness back in. I think that's really important as part of this decision. And I think it's something that the FCC will look very carefully at when it, I think, inevitably has to take this issue up again, is that when you leave it out there with this concept of revocation through at any time and through any reasonable means, I think that you have to read reasonableness both ways, is that it just can't be through all of these different sources. And, you know, I call up a teller at a bank to ask my balance and I say, oh, by the way, don't have your bank send me text messages anymore. If you've set up these easy to use and clear opt-out methods, you have a reasonable argument against revocation. Important point.
Don, I'm glad you brought up Reyes, because I think as far as revocation of consent, Reyes is a very important case. And it just to describe it to everyone, it was the consent was included as an express provision of a contract to lease an automobile from Lincoln. And the court, the Second Circuit, concluded that allowing him to revoke his consent unilaterally would be counter to black letter law that one party may not alter a bilateral contract by revoking a term without the counterparty's consent. So this decision seems to be at odds with the FCC's broad definition of consent, and also splits with the Third and Eleventh Circuits. So I do think that this is something that's on the FCC's radar, and it's something that perhaps the industry or the FCC will take up on their own as far as maybe a declaratory order at some point in the future.
You know, I think that everything, I agree with everything that Don and Scott have said about the consent and the reasonableness and the ability to litigate on this. But I think one thing that we can't lose sight of is we need to train our people to be sensitive to things that sound like a revocation of consent, and to be very, very careful so that when somebody doesn't use the magic words but makes it clear they don't want another message or they don't want another call on this number, that we take it off the system. Because litigation issues are great to have, or litigation offenses are great to have, but they're expensive. And having somebody just say, I think you revoked, and take that number out of your database is a better approach in the long run.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just, again, hoping that the FCC does provide, especially with revocation, some clarity and certainty, because that's really the enduring challenge of administrative governance, particularly in the regulatory context.
So we've talked about having more defenses now. Does that mean that you think that the number of lawsuits that have been filed alleging violations of the TCPA are going to maybe not decrease, but maybe not keep increasing? Can you give any sense on whether you think you'll see the industry will see as many, fewer, or more TCPA lawsuits? And Tom, I'll start with you.
Oh, gee. I don't see the number. You know, if the decision had come out the opposite, then you would have seen a huge ratcheting up of the number of cases. Here, I don't think in the long run you're going to see that increase. I think in the short run you're going to see people arguing that their client isn't the snake in the grass. That notwithstanding this decision, the language of the TCPA says what it says, and that they should be entitled to relief based on it. You know, I wouldn't. Let's put it this way: I wouldn't pillow my head tonight thinking that I'll never see another TCPA case.
Anyone else want to offer any prognostications? Go ahead, Scott.
You know, I think the TCPA is still the telephone consumer attorney profit statute. And so yes, things got better, but unfortunately the profit motive is still very strong in bringing TCPA actions.
Yes, if do never underestimate the imagination of the plaintiff's bar. This may have resolved and made more defensible certain aspects of the TCPA, but they will come up with others. And until we have the clarity we need, we will see them. I think that persons may have more of a desire to litigate now than they did last Thursday. And particularly where the risks are high and the exposure is great in a class. But I think as long as there's payouts on TCPA's cases, there's going to be lawsuits. And it seems like everyone and their cousin has determined that there are payouts. And so you see a lot of pro se's, and some of them all of you know already, that make quite a good living filing these lawsuits.
All right, we've only got a few minutes left, and we've got a lot of questions to get to, so we're going to try and rocket through these as best we can. Here's one. Are there best practices for accepting auto-dialing revocations? Does anyone want to tackle that?
I think operationally, my recommendation is, however they decide to try to tell you, no, don't call anymore, honor that. It's not your job to deem whether or not something is reasonable or not. If a consumer is trying to revoke, you honor it.
Here's a question specific to a robocalling case against JP Morgan Chase. Does anyone expect that case to be thrown out thanks to the DC Circuit Court's ruling? If so, will other rulings adverse to banks be thrown out?
It's going to depend on the facts and circumstances. It's facts and circumstances of the case. I mean, ATDS is not resolved. I mean, it's the broad scope of it is pulled back. You can't rely on the 2015 order to define the scope. And so we get to interpose those defenses that we had before the 2015 order and that some of us use even after it. So, if the case involves revocation of consent and the entire theory of liability is that there were two calls and the second call after the first call is an automatic liability, you know, you have a defense there now. So you have to look at it that way. If it's a revocation of consent, you can now deploy the reasonableness of how that revocation was made in a more articulate way by pointing to this decision. So I think in some instances, yes, cases will go away. And I think in others, it's gonna continue to litigate to a disposition. I know that doesn't answer the question, but it's the best way that I could provide you with some prediction as to how this is going to play out, because each of these cases, I think, have little nuances to them that could make the case successful or not. But now you've at least got a quiver of more defenses than you did last week.
Yeah, and this question raises another question, actually, which is all the cases that were stayed pending this appeal. And the one case that I'm thinking of now is the Gensel case, which is, I think, in Wisconsin. And in that case, the court found that it seemed the dissenting commissioners, the FCC, got it right, that the majority's interpretation of the term capacity contradicts the plain language of the TCPA. So I am going to be curious to see if I don't have a listing of all the cases that have been stayed and are still active, but it would be interesting to follow those cases to see how they're finally decided.
Here's a question. So you're saying a debtor's attorney who sued us for 23 calls on a dialer without once calling us back to say it is a cell phone and do not call, we now have a defense?
Well, I can't give legal advice, right? Because we said that at the
right.
beginning. But if the theory was that it was a reassigned number, is that what the question is asking, or if it was a revocation?
No, it was.
Why don't you read the question one more time, Mike?
Yeah. Sure. A debtor's attorney who sued us for 23 calls made on the dialer without once calling us back to say it is a cell phone and do not call. I think it's a revocation of consent.
I don't know.
I would need additional facts.
It sounds to me almost
facts.
Like yeah. it's a... Yeah. Because it's not clear. I mean, go ahead, Tom.
No, I mean, it really isn't clear what the case is involving, but I think we could say, without giving legal advice, that you're in no worse situation than you were before this case came out, and
right.
you may have a defense.
Okay. That's a nice way to put it. And with only a couple of minutes left, but I'd like to give each of the panelists a chance to sort of summarize, maybe give some final talking points or some final thoughts, and Tom, we'll start with you.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I think the case is hugely important because of what the world would look like if it had come out the other direction. It would have been very, very challenging to do business, if the rule had been upheld. I think that, we need to, as an industry, be very focused on what our policies are, what our procedures are, and how we train our people for dealing with people that are raising potential TCPA issues. With that being said, hey, we've got more arrows in the quiver than we did on Thursday.
Excellent. Thank you. Scott, your turn.
I just want to bring up that there are still many open items regarding the TCPA and that we need to get clarity on. This is certainly a victory, but things such as, there's still split authority as to what constitutes willful under the TCPA. There's still split authority over prior express consent provided by a spouse or someone with sufficient intersection with the party's interest. But I do want to just go back to, for myself, when the ruling first came out, the declaratory ruling order, I was giving a TCPA presentation at the Lenda conference. And it was one of those experiences where everyone in the room had this incredulous look when I started describing the FCC's new rulemaking, especially that potential ability is consistent with the interpretation of capacity. And at first glance, it was disbelief. And then the turn into the question of how are we legitimate business owners, job creators, all with an eye towards the future of financial technology, supposed to comply with all these contradictory, arbitrary, and capricious rules. And when they started looking at the damages, and especially for willful or knowing violations, I'm just happy to say that the DC Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, for the most part, with the disturbed ambience in the room on that day.
Awesome. Thank you. And Don, your turn.
So the great things, potential capacity, and that the fact that I could tack something onto a system, and even though I never did, and should be able to dial it, that portion of that order being vacated, excellent news. The single call safe harbor being gone, excellent news. And a revocation of consent, some wonderful words in there about the developing opt-out procedures and looking at reasonableness of how consent should be revoked, all wonderful news. But it's still a high-risk area of making calls. And to echo what we've said through this, have those robust policies and procedures in place. Look at those reassigned number lists. Have your people look carefully at what persons are saying when they're talking about their calls, so that you develop that reasonable basis procedure in the event that you have to deal with a reassigned call claim.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Before I let everybody go, I want to thank Tom, Don, and Scott for their insights and their time today. This webinar definitely would not have been possible without their participation. I also want to thank TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.tcnp3.com to learn more about the company. Thank you to everybody who registered, who attended, who listened, who asked questions, and who participated in today's webinar. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for more news and more webinars in the very near future. A recording of this event should be posted up on the site in the next day or so, and I hope everybody enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.